The greatest story ever told is a true story. It is a story of adventures, battles, kings and queens, heroes and villains, good and evil, history and prophecy. It is your story. Come join the adventure of the Bible story. Chapter 142, The Fall of Samaria. Conditions in Judah and Israel could not have been more different. King Hezekiah's rise to the throne in Judah brought instant blessings as he valiantly led the nation back into obedience to God. Meanwhile, in Israel, the burden of paying tribute to Assyria became heavier and heavier as God removed the physical blessings from the land. Through Hezekiah, God gave one final opportunity for the individual Israelites to repent and celebrate the Passover with Judah. A few did, but most mocked the idea. The first few months of Hezekiah's reign produced more blessings than Judah had seen in decades. God was rewarding the nation's obedience to his laws. Immediately following the celebration of Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread, the Jews and some Israelites were ready to rid the land of the pagan religion observed under King Ahaz. The priests' instructions, coupled with the newfound happiness they experienced by keeping God's law, made the people see just how wretched idolatrous worship was. Teams of people immediately set out with large hammers to demolish the pagan temples and saws to cut down the groves. Riding through the hilly terrain of Judah, the teams located and destroyed all objects of worship. Many of these were located on the hilltops because pagans superstitiously believed the elevation brought their worship closer to God. Soon all the idols were smashed and cut down throughout Judah. But that wasn't enough for these people who were so zealous for God. The demolition teams continued destroying the idolatrous places up into the land of the northern tribes as well. In Jerusalem, they destroyed one of the famous objects of antiquity, the bronze serpent. God had commanded Moses to make this to stop the plague of serpents killing the Israelites during their journey through the wilderness. God had never intended this object to be worshipped, but during the reign of Ahaz, the people burned incense to the bronze snake as an idol. Hezekiah decided to destroy the 700-year-old artifact because it was being used sinfully. Recognize this important lesson. You may have something in your life, perhaps a hobby or other interests, that in itself is not wrong or sinful. But if you allow that hobby to become so important it takes your focus off God, you made it into an idol. That idol should be crushed, just as Hezekiah destroyed the bronze serpent. The next objective for Hezekiah was to reinstate God's laws of tithing that had been long abandoned. The ability of the priests and Levites to fulfill their religious duties depended on the nation's adherence to these special laws. When Israel came into the Promised Land, every tribe was given a plot of land as part of its family inheritance. Every tribe, that is, except Levi. During the nation's time at Mount Sinai, God set apart the Levites to be his servants working in and around the tabernacle and later the temple. God did not want them to be distracted from the work of God by having to provide a living from the land. He instructed the Israelites to give their tithes to the Levites, ensuring that the needs of the Levites were provided for. The tribe of Levi was fully dependent on the tithes of the nation for its survival. Sadly, though God elevated the tribe of Levi to perform this sacred function, they were the first to suffer when unrighteous kings ruled because the people stopped tithing. During the rule of King Ahaz, many Levites had to work the farms of others to provide food for their families. Hezekiah corrected this situation by restoring the Levites to their rightful roles. He called for all the priestly orders to be reinstated, with each Levitical family returning to their historic roles, just as King David had organized. Once the Levites were in place, King Hezekiah sent out a command to all the land of Judah, stating that everyone must tithe on his increase. This meant that 10% of the harvest was to come to Jerusalem for a distribution to the priests, as well as provide for the daily sacrifices at the temple. Rather than responding grudgingly to giving up some of their produce, the Jews were delighted to pay God his 10%. Starting in the third month, proceeds from the wheat harvest began to pour into Jerusalem from the farmlands of Judah. Interestingly, a multitude of archaeological discoveries may attest to the massive reintroduction of tithing during the reign of King Hezekiah. About 10 to 15% of all storage vessels discovered from this period have a specific inscription impressed on their handles. Part of the inscription reads La Melech in ancient Hebrew, which is translated as to the king in English, meaning belonging to the king. The other text on the handles mentions one of four cities that was spaced throughout Judah. Some archaeologists believe these storage jars were used to transport much of the grain harvest to Jerusalem. First, the farmer would deliver his grain to one of the four distribution cities indicated on the jar handles. Then these grain-filled jars would be shipped to Jerusalem, designated by their La Melech inscriptions as official business of the king. For the next few months of harvest, tithes and offerings poured into the temple grounds. One day, around the time of the Feast of Tabernacles that year, King Hezekiah went to the temple to inspect whether the Levites were receiving enough supplies. He was surprised to see great heaps of produce lying in the area around the temple. "What is the meaning of all these extra supplies?" the king asked Azariah the high priest. "These tithes were to be given out to all the Levites and to their families." With a large smile on his face, Azariah answered the king, "We have already given food to our families. We have taken what we need and are full. Everything that you see is extra. God has blessed his people with the most productive farming season we have ever seen." "That's amazing," the king declared. Even Hezekiah was surprised by how much God was blessing the nation. That is often the case when someone chooses to obey God's laws of tithing. He is blessed abundantly for it. "Well, we can't have all this produce just sitting here exposed to the elements," the king declared. "It's time to build extra chambers around the temple to store the supplies. These tithes belong to God, and we must be careful how we treat them." Hezekiah set up an administration of capable Levites to take care of the growing amount of grains, oils, and wine. Faithful men were chosen out of the group to ensure that God's tithes didn't go missing. Within 7 months of coming to the throne in Judah, King Hezekiah had completely turned the nation around. Of course, it was God who had heaped the blessings upon the people, but that was largely in response to the work that Hezekiah did. He strived to obey all of God's laws, no matter the cost. God also took note of the speed at which Hezekiah acted. He never procrastinated. He never put off doing what was right. He used his kingly authority to change the nation, and the people under him rejoiced because of it. Meanwhile, in Samaria, after rejecting Hezekiah's call to return to the worship of the true God, the nation of Israel was falling apart. King Hoshea was tired of the burdensome tribute payments to the Assyrians. Reassessing his strategy, he decided to stop paying. He entered a military alliance with King Saul of Egypt. He was sure that if the Assyrian king came against him, Egypt would come to his aid. When the tribute payment did not arrive in Nineveh, Shalmaneser, the next king of Assyria after Tiglath-Pileser, knew something was awry. Sensing that Hoshea was rebelling against his empire, the king mustered his army for another incursion into the land of Israel. Given the history of the Israelites and their tendency to quickly switch alliances, Assyria decided to make an example of Hoshea by imprisoning him in his own dungeon as punishment for his rebellion. Soon after Hoshea was imprisoned, Shalmaneser decided that Israel had been a thorn in Assyria's side long enough. The king instructed his army to take all of Israel captive to be used as slaves. The massive Assyrian army mobilized, spreading through the land of Israel from the Sea of Galilee to the Mediterranean. The Assyrian strategy involved conquering the smaller cities first. Bit by bit, the nation fell, while its army and the people retreated to the capital, Samaria. Conquering Samaria proved much more difficult. With his massive army surrounding the city, the king of Assyria ordered scouts to locate weak spots in the city wall. While the Assyrian army could win a decisive victory in open battle, conquering a city surrounded by high, strong walls required great effort. The Israelites held an advantage as they rained arrows and large objects down from the walls onto their attackers. Eventually, the Assyrian scouts reported back to the king, "We have investigated the city wall, and we can't find any weak portions."
"What do you mean?
No weak portions? Surely that's impossible," fired back the king.
"The wall has been soundly built on top of the hill," replied the scout. "I recommend attacking the main gate."
Shalmaneser took a few moments to process the intelligence report and weigh his decision. The main city gate was made out of wood and would be easier to penetrate than the stone city wall. However, when the city was built, the Israelite architects had taken this into account. The entrance to Samaria was guarded by not one gate, but two. If the Assyrian army penetrated the outer gate, they would find themselves channeled into a passage between the gates, which had firing positions all along the walls, exposing them to crossfire from two, three, or four directions. Since the army would be unable to go further until the next gate was battered down, the Israelite archers could easily pick them off. Shalmaneser made his decision. "We will not attack the city," he said, surprising his men. "Instead, we will turn Samaria into one giant prison with no one going in or out. Eventually, when those rebels run out of food, they will surrender." The Siege of Samaria. Following the king's announcement, the Assyrian generals commanded the army to set up camp completely encircling the city. Shalmaneser decided to use the time that they would be waiting out Israel to gather intelligence on the neighboring countries like Tyre, Philistia, and Judah. As the weeks turned into months, the Assyrian king began to grow restless. Life inside of Samaria grew progressively worse. Israel's capital turned into a ghetto. As supplies dwindled, division among the Israelites increased as they fought over scraps of food and water. Eventually, they turned on one another. Rival gangs within the city murdered each other to control the food that was left. Israelite soldiers barely managed to stay in control of the mobs. As months turned into years, and the stores of food were depleted, the Israelites descended into the most base of situations, human cannibalism. Finally, after more than 2 years laying siege to the city, the Assyrian army made one more mighty assault. This proved too much for the Israelites to withstand. The years of rations and food shortages, coupled with the plaguing fear from the army camped outside its walls, had taken too great a toll. With one full frontal assault on the city, Samaria fell. The Bible briefly describes Samaria's demise, indicating its ignominious end. In the ninth year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria took Samaria. Israel almost lost in captivity. It was the general policy of the Assyrian Empire to relocate captured peoples far from their homeland. They reasoned that if native peoples had less attachment to their land, they would be less likely to rebel again. Therefore, the northern tribes of Israel were rounded up and exiled from the land of Israel, never to return. The northern tribes of Israel became known to historians as the Lost Ten Tribes. It is important to remember that the tribes exiled at this time were only the northern tribes, not the southern tribes. The Jewish nation remained in its homeland for over 100 more years. The main reason it is hard to trace where the tribes of Israel went is that they no longer kept the Sabbath day. God had created the Sabbath to be an eternal sign of his relationship with his people. He had commanded the Israelites to keep his Sabbath forever. But since the time the kingdom split and the northern tribes came under the rule of King Jeroboam I, the Israelites had forsaken God's true Sabbath day. Yet far from being removed from history, these tribes continue to exist, but by different names and in different places. Secular and biblical sources reveal that over the next few centuries, these Lost Ten Tribes eventually settled in northwestern Europe. Hundreds of years before Israel was taken into captivity, God brought the Israelites out of Egypt and promised them that if they were obedient to his laws, he would shower them with great blessings. God's promise of material prosperity through Moses was an affirmation of God's unconditional promise to Abraham centuries earlier. While those blessings would affect all the tribes of Israel, the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh specifically received the birthright promise. When God spoke through Moses, he also warned Israel that if it refused to keep God's law, those promises of wealth and prosperity would not be conferred on the nation. If Abraham's descendants rejected God and disobeyed him, God said he would curse Israel by postponing the fulfillment of his promises to Abraham. Because the kingdom of Israel failed to obey God's laws, God did postpone those blessings for seven prophetic times. In the language of biblical prophecy, a time is a specific period, a prophetic 360-day year. Each of those prophetic days represents a year in the fulfillment of Israel's punishment. Israel was denied the birthright promise for seven prophetic times, or seven 360-day years, a total of 2,520 days. When you apply the day-for-a-year principle, that becomes a punishment of 2,520 years. So, 2,520 years after Israel went into captivity in 721 to 718 BC, God would begin to bless Israel with the material prosperity promised to Abraham. By the time the blessings were ready to be conferred in AD 1800 to 1803, the Israelites had completely lost their identity. Most of the descendants of the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh came to inhabit Great Britain and the United States of America. These nations experienced a rapid surge in prosperity at the turn of the 19th century. The modern Israelites in those nations attributed their blessings to their own resourcefulness or to their Christian heritage. Actually, the stunning national rise to power of Great Britain and America was the direct fulfillment of God conferring the blessings of Abraham upon them. Babylonians colonized the land of Israel. When the king of Assyria removed Israel from its territory and located it elsewhere within the Assyrian Empire, he also decided to colonize the land of Israel with a foreign people. The king gathered people from northern Syria and Babylon and placed them in the former cities of Israel. These people would later become known as Samaritans because of where they settled. Upon settling into their new land, the Babylonian foreigners quickly ran into trouble. While the land had rested without inhabitants, wild beasts had multiplied. Lions quickly killed many of the incoming Babylonians. The superstitious foreigners believed they had upset the gods of the land and that those gods were directing the lion attacks. One of the Samaritan leaders hatched a plan.
Send a message to the Assyrian king and ask him to return one of the priests of the land to us. We will learn about the god of the land, and this will stop these savage beasts.
The Assyrian king accepted the Samaritan's proposal and commanded one of the Israelite priests to return to Samaria to teach the foreigners about God. Remember, however, that the northern tribes had long turned away from the worship of the true God of Israel. Under King Jeroboam, they had set up their own religious festivals and used idols to worship God, rather than teaching the Samaritans about the true God. This Israelite priest taught them a corrupted religion. The Samaritans bought into the false worship of the true God, even as they maintained their own Babylonian traditions. These were the ancestors of the very Samaritans who were there centuries later during the time of Jesus Christ. These first century Samaritans worshipped a sorcerer named Simon Magus during the times of the apostles. To be continued in our next episode, and continue the adventure by reading the Bible story. Find it under the Resources tab at pcg.church.